Well, I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, James Foley. Welcome, James.
Thanks for having me.
We'll come to some of your other books, but your latest one, which has brought us together, is Stelephant.
Yes.
Do I say that right?
You can say it however you like. I say it's Stelephant, like elephant, but with Stella at the start.
And Stella's the star.
She is. Stella is the star. Stella means star, of course. I'm sure you knew that. She is an elephant who lives in an anthropomorphic world where animals have jobs and wear clothes and walk around alongside people. And
you mean they don't normally?
Yeah, well, and some people do. Some people dress up their dogs. But these ones, they talk and have feelings and thoughts and everything. And this elephant, Stella, she wants to become an astronaut. So she goes to Space Command to apply. And they come up with all sorts of reasons why they think that an elephant is bad news. Because up to that point, it's just been humans, blokes, essentially, only blokes, and a couple of dogs and a couple of chimps in this world who've been to space. And well, Stella's going to be the first astronaut. The first elephant astronaut, I mean.
Well, looking at the first page, these look like a lot of tech billionaires who've probably all been to space as well.
Yeah, potentially, yeah. These guys, they've all got the sort of the classic sort of crew cut astronaut hairdo.
Tom Cruise style.
Yeah, exactly right. You know, they're all sort of, it's very sort of 60s inspired. I went to look at a lot of the old Apollo astronauts and their astronaut portraits. That inspired some of the original artwork. And I guess just 60s colour and 60s graphic design has sort of inspired a bit of this as well.
And here's the codger who runs Space Command.
That's just, he's like the gatekeeper. He's kind of the secretary at the front desk. So Stella rocks up and tries to hand in her application, and this man's always coming up with excuses.
Well, it does get me thinking. People are always wondering about the future of Frio, what its economic sort of reason for existence is. James, maybe Space Command should have an office in Market Street, Fremantle.
Oh, that'd be fantastic. We could all apply. It'd be wonderful.
Is there a future, do you think, in space? I mean, obviously,
for
everyone
kind,
thinks there is. Yeah, you think are you committed? Is Stella committed?
I'm fascinated by space travel and always have been. And I mean, lots of people say that, you know, what is the point of spending all the money on NASA and space travel and all that sort of stuff? What's it actually giving us? But they've done studies and found that the return on the investment in terms of the technology that gets developed that feeds back into society is huge. Something as simple as Velcro that was developed for space. Exactly right. All this amazing stuff was developed originally for space. And the things that we're learning about human health and all that sort of stuff is amazing.
Now, tell me this. This isn't Stella's first adventure. Or is it?
It is in this universe, yeah. I mean, there's lots of things in the sketches when I was developing the story where there were other potential versions of the story. She was doing some other sorts of things. But this is basically her deciding this is what she wants to do as her job.
Wants to do. And to use the expression, who's the target audience? Is it parents of young children?
Well, I mean, picture books are stereotypically aimed at children, and then also at parents and grandparents and aunties and uncles and people who buy those books. But picture books don't have to just be for tiny kids. I mean, things like board books, essentially, yeah, they're for little kids to learn how to count and letters of the alphabet and colours and things. But picture books can have deeper levels of meaning and can be, you know, really great for high school students to study and to learn about literature and visual literacy, and it can be great just for older people to read as well, just because.
Well, I fit into that latter category, and yeah. I open the book up and I read one ordinary Monday at 9 a.m. precisely. Stella walked into Space Command. "Hello," she said, "I'd like to become an astronaut." Well, I start cackling to myself. I think that's lovely. Do kids have the same reaction when you try this?
It's funny, like I didn't actually test the story out on kids before I wrote it and started sketching it all up. But it has been interesting to read it to classes and groups of kids in, you know, bookshops and things. They all seem to pause and laugh at the same sorts of spots. And it's a sort of story that I think probably happens with a lot of stories, but they just get really quiet and just really listen really carefully, which I really, really like. And there's certain parts where they seem to get even quieter. Right towards the climax of the story, it just nobody talks. It's really lovely when that your story has that effect on people.
Now, I get the impression that your art is as performative as it is written and visual. Is that reasonable? You get out and about, talk to kids.
Yeah. I suppose there is a part of that. It is really lovely to be able to go and share your stories with groups. And a lot of my job is going out into classes and schools and libraries and going to writers' festivals and giving talks and running workshops and all that sort of thing. And I mean, any picture book is meant to be shared and read.
Now, this isn't your first venture into all of this. What was the very first publication in this line of work?
Well, Stelephant is book number 18 that I've worked on. And the very first one was also with Fremantle Press, with the same publisher. And it's called The Last Viking. And it's written by Norman Jorgensen, who's a Perth-based author, a good mate of mine. And it came out 10 years ago.
Amazing, isn't it? And you contributed the drawings.
Yes, that's right. And we actually worked pretty closely on... we ended up doing two books together, The Last Viking and The Last Viking Returns. Normally, an author and an illustrator of a children's book don't actually communicate with each other during the creative process.
You're given the words and the illustrator illustrates.
That's it, exactly right. And the editor or the image director or whatever at the publishing house, they're the go-between. But we actually worked quite closely together on the whole process, throwing ideas back and forth about pictures and words,
right,
which was fun. It's not recommended usually, but it was useful for us. We got some better ideas by bouncing things back and forth.
Not sure how Elton John and Bernie Taupin worked, but I suspect quite remotely.
I've got no idea. Yeah, perhaps.
So tell me a little bit about, we'll come back to the words, but about the illustrator's role and responsibility, and you've started to embark upon that. Someone say, "Oh, James, I want you. I've got these words, I've got this story, it's going to be great, and I've got an idea of what the visuals ought to look like. I want it to be in that cartoon style or fresh that kids will look at and love."
Yes.
Starting to tell you what I want, but what do you do when you get my words?
When I get the words, usually if I'm working to another writer's words, normally I don't get to communicate with them at all, and normally I don't really want to.
Yep.
Because they may have their own ideas about what things should be, and maybe it's important to the story or maybe it's not, but my training and my expertise is going to be in the illustration side and in bringing that to life in a way that suits the tone of the story and that tells the story in a sequential way clearly to the reader and to perhaps a non-verbal reader as well, and also that is going to fit in with current market trends to some degree. It's going to be of a publishable quality, and perhaps not every writer is going to have a clear vision of what that will entail, all those things, which is why they're the writer and why I'm the illustrator.
But then there's the occasion to jump forward where you've written the words.
Yes.
Do you write the words and then sort of say, well, that's James Foley, the writer, the author, I'll just pass this over to James Foley, the illustrator, and see what he does with it.
It's not really a clear division of labour for me. It's mostly all just meshed together. Normally a story idea will start with some sort of picture that has appeared in my head, or perhaps it's appeared on the page in a sketchbook or a random scrap of paper or a handkerchief or napkin in a cafe. And then that idea will, that image will just sort of not want to go away. It will be sort of lodged in my head and a story will start to build around it. And then I'll go to the words and I'll start figuring out the plot of the story bit by bit. And once I've got the beginning, middle and end all figured out, then I'll go back to pictures and I will start to sketch out tiny rough drawings for every page in the book.
Well, going back to the Elton John analogy, he comes up with the music. He
yes.
writes the sound, and then someone says, I can imagine some words for this. Do you write the words and leave them unfixed, or do they get influenced by the drawings, the illustrations?
There's a bit of to and fro, really. So I'll usually have a few images in my head of different scenes in the book, and I'll figure out where they go in the order of things, and then I'll start to write out all the words. And then I'll start to paginate it too, start to divide it into pages, and then perhaps within two images or panels on each page as well. And then I might realize that I've got too many words on a page. I don't need to say everything because the pictures can show some of that, so I can cut a sentence out. Maybe I'll realize that a page doesn't need any words at all, so I can cut those words out completely. Sometimes I'll realize that, oh, there's a gap here. This particular image needs a bit of extra words. There's a bit of a plot hole here, or this needs some connective tissue over here. So then there's a back and forth between pictures and words during the drafting process. And then once that's all finalized and then edited and approved by the publisher, then we can start working on the final artwork.
Now, take Stelephant.
Mm.
Are there some messages, subliminal or quite overt, that you are trying to communicate to the world?
If themes not? And morals and that sort of stuff?
Oh, well, themes and morals.
It's not something that I tend to overtly think about when I start making a story. I don't go, oh, I'm going to make a story about climate change, or I'm going to make a story about racism. Or, you know, I don't start out like that, because I feel that if you aim for something like that, then the story can come out very didactic. But it just kind of made sense that this elephant, who was always a girl in all of my sketches, she rocks up to this scientific place that's staffed and run entirely by men, and it ended up becoming an analogy for feminism, which is why the logo for Space Command is based around the male symbol as well. So it's got like a rocket launching off and everything, but it's the outline of the male symbol, and that's why they're all blokes here. And that's a bit of a contrast then between the front end papers, we call them, the decorative parts at the very start of a book when you open them up. All these blokes here and very rigid order of pictures, everyone's the same, it's a cookie cutter approach, very cool, non-welcoming colours as well. And we compare that to our end papers towards the back of the book, where we have a new facility set up by Stella where everyone is welcome and much warmer colours, and the portraits are all higgledy-piggledy, and all sorts of animals can be let in here regardless of their size and shape and what their needs are. Some fish, a whale, animals with massive antlers that would be very hard to make a space helmet for, but they're going to find a way to make all that happen.
Now, James, I imagine inspiration or directions that you've taken in illustrating and writing come from all sorts of places, but I've spotted along the way that you're a bit of a Marvel comics and...
Yes. Yeah. I love comics. I love Marvel films. I love just film in general. So mostly...
Was that from an early age?
Yeah. I mean, as soon as I was allowed to watch television and cartoons and all that sort of stuff, I was completely obsessed. It's definitely square eyes. But it's given me a really strong, I guess, visual vocabulary for the way that stories are told visually, and a lot of pop culture reference points too. I mean, there's nothing obvious in here, but a lot of my comics have got little Jurassic Park references flicked into them, filtered into them. This one in particular, it just feels like a movie in my head. And there's sorts of cliches that you find in astronaut stories in here. You know, astronaut training montages, that sort of thing. Weightlessness training and building the rocket and the right stuff. A little homage here. You always got to have your characters, your crew walking heroically and stoically and slowly towards the camera. Little vest here from Apollo 13. Little references here and there, just based on lots of astronaut movies, space movies, and just movies in general that I've watched over the years.
And before you produced Stelephant, you were writing in different formats. I mean, there's a lovely book I think people like called Chickensaurus.
Yes, that came out last year, yeah. It's the longest book I've done. It's 200 pages long. It's a comic book.
And who's the star of this one?
That's Sally Tinker. So that's book four in the S. Tinker Inc. series. Sally is the world's foremost inventor under 12, and she's always making strange inventions, and her baby brother Joe is usually destroying them. But this one's a little different because this one has her nemesis in it, who is Dexter Maelstrom. He's always coming second in the inventing championships behind Sally, and he has invented a way to de-evolve chickens into dinosaurs And he's demonstrating this invention to Sally, and then, of course, chaos ensues.
The way the story is presented here, it's not in the colour of Stellarton.
Yes.
It's in a
black and white.
Timeless black and white.
Yes.
Which the aficionado will love.
Yes.
Do love. And but the presentation is different again. How do you describe this? Is this more comic?
Yeah. Comic, graphic novel. It's there's lots of similarities between comics and picture books. And quite often I'm using panels in my picture book.
Yes.
Illustration and layout anyway. They're both stories that tell images. They tell stories with a sequence of images. So they have that completely thing in similar. It's just that comic books tend to use speech bubbles more, and they tend to use panels more than picture books do. They both just feel kind of very cinematic to me anyway. I'm usually seeing stories as movies in my head before I start to draw them on the page, and then I'm picking the still images that are going to tell the story best.
Now, I'm always fascinated in any creative endeavour when we go black and white, when we go colour, when we do something in between.
Yes.
Go realist, when we go sort of entirely cartoon.
Yeah.
What are the choices? What's involved in making it? It could be a question of production and it's quick and easy to get out.
Yeah, I mean, the graphic novels, they've all been black and white mostly because they're cheaper to print that way. There's just a lot more pages. The price point that people are willing to pay for a book like this as well is lower, so you want to be able to print them at a reasonable cost to yourself before you then sell them for another cost. And also they're very, it's much quicker to make when it's black and white. If I had to do a 200-page comic in full colour, it would take me years.
It just strikes me that it might also be, if it were all in colour, that it might be overwhelming.
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, I've seen some great ones in full colour, but they would have just taken the creators a really long time. And so it's much quicker just to work with in black and white for me. Although, you know, making Stellarton in full colour was brilliant. It was the first full colour picture book I got to work on for about eight or nine years. So it was really lovely to get back into that world of full colour.
So, I mean, if you take Chickensaurus, the book is sort of 8 inches, to use my old expressions, by probably about 4 or 5 or something.
Yes.
So it's a little book, like more of a book, and you hold it in your hand.
That's right.
And so the black and the white enable you to focus on the words. You get caught up in the story.
True.
But when we're talking about Stellarton,
yes,
we're talking about a fabulous, really a coffee table.
It's a large size. Yeah, it's almost like a widescreen film then when you open the book.
I mean, it's a foot wide and 9 inches.
Yeah.
Long or whichever, I've probably gotten them the wrong way around.
That's
but it really is a one you sit on the bed with the kids and you
yes.
go through the pages. And
yeah.
There's so much to find on the page.
It's something that can fill your peripheral vision when you've got it on your lap as a kid,
yeah.
Which is lovely.
Yeah. Now, what have you learnt along the way when it comes to communicating with the audience you're looking at? I mean, are you talking about young adults down to small kids learning to read, or are you...
Yeah, probably. What have I learnt? That you can never talk down to them. You're never trying to dumb things down, really. You've got to really just always try and make something that's the best quality that you can and have respect for your audience, really. Because they deserve it. And there's no point in spending months and months and months making a story just for the heck of it. You got to really believe in what you're doing and really work towards making it a story that is going to be worth the time of these kids.
Hmm. And on that front, what is worth the time for the kids? What do kids, do you think? Do they tell you what they want out of it?
I think at the very least, they just want stories that are entertaining. Yeah. And we all want that. It's got to be that basic level of entertainment. If you can have a little bit of education and inspiration in there too, that's great. But it doesn't have to be the main thing. We're not trying to make a textbook here. We're trying to make a book.
So how do you measure, and it might depend on the age of the kids, I'm sure it does, the entertainment value?
I don't really know. I think you get a group of kids in front of you, if you're reading to them and they're looking in your direction, then that's a good thing.
And if they laugh out loud?
Yeah, if they laugh at the funny bits and if they
go quiet at the other bits?
Yeah, exactly right. If they actually look like they're interested, that's how you gauge it. If they're just running around playing with other stuff, talking to each other, then perhaps the story is not that interesting. Or perhaps, you know, they just had a lot of red cordial for play lunch. Who knows?
So a bit like the perils of being a stand-up comedian, things might fall flat and you're trying to avoid that happening.
Yeah, yeah. And look, not every audience is going to be exactly the same either, really. So you take an average over all the classes that you see, because some classes do not react exactly the way to other classes. It's really interesting, the chances that I've gotten to go to, say, remote Aboriginal community schools compared to city schools. They respond really differently to the same sort of presentation that I give. And it actually is wonderful to go to those remote schools, because they don't want me to stand up and do the usual sort of funny, almost stand-up comedy sort of presentation, really. They just want me to sit down and have a yarn with them and draw together. And it's so wonderful just to have that pressure taken off, just to be more present in that sort of arena.
And you've just reminded me of something. Mm. Is that something you do in the course of your presentations or workshops with kids, that you're getting them to draw?
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. And it'll either be, you know, it depends on how much time we have. I can just do some really quick little exercises and show them how to draw some of my characters. But what I really love more than that is to be encouraging them to come up with their own ideas, because they come up with the most hilarious things. And I'm not trying to get kids to become copies of me in my creative style. I really want to encourage them to make their own stories and to feel confident that that's worthy, and they can just muck around and have fun with that.
And what about the reading side of it? Do you want, particularly, say, at Stellafont, mum and dad, mum or dad, grandma, granddad, somebody else, adult, to read this to the kids? Or are you hoping that they will want to pick this up and read it themselves?
Oh, both. Yeah, yeah. Look, it can be for younger kids who aren't reading yet, and it can be for kids who do know how to read, but there's still a lot of pleasure in reading a story together. You know, even if kids can read this on their own, it's lovely to still be able to share a story with someone else.
It's a loving process.
Exactly right. And not to read it to the kid, but to read it with the child. I've got some friends who are speech pathologists, and they've written a book about book sharing. And they talk about the triangle between the book and the adult and the child. So both adult and child can see the book at the same time, and you share the story. And it's not just about improving the child's literacy in that process, it's also about bonding and everything too. It's a really lovely little relationship you can have between adult and child and book.
And books can be loved just on their own as a result of that triangle, I suspect.
Yeah.
And it's treasured.
That's right. And that's what we want to be doing, not just teaching kids to read, but teaching kids to love to read. Because if they really love the process of reading just for the sake of it, then Australian research has shown that they're going to get better outcomes with their own literacy and pretty much across the board with their own school outcomes. As simple as just loving to read is a huge indicator.
Now, we've got all of these hard copy books,
yes,
of one sort and another in front of us.
Yeah, yeah.
I read a lot, and I would say most of it, a good part of it, is e-reader on Kindle, for example.
Yeah, sure.
Is there a present children's young adult literature that's electronic? Is there a future, or am I raising heretical thoughts here?
Oh, no. Look, there's room for all sorts of opportunities and stuff here. I think there isn't just as much take-up of picture books in the digital arena because picture books come in all sorts of different formats, all sorts of different sizes, heights and widths, and they don't fit necessarily that easily onto a screen. Also, some parents are just wanting to limit their child's screen time, so they don't want to have books on the screen, they want to have those hard copies. Also, it's just more tactile. There's something more real and more human, I think, about holding the actual book in your hands, particularly with young kids. And you can't have a pop-up book on the screen. There's certain things like that, you know, lift the flaps and all that amazing stuff. It can't really be replicated on the screen. I think also when you put a screen in front of kids,
I reckon they'd rather just watch a movie or play a game on the screen.
That's and, what and I they're think, familiar with, yeah.
Yeah, I think the there's still a place, especially with very young kids, for picture books, just to still be books. But I'm sure there's lots of older kids, teens, who are reading YA novels on screens. I read a lot of comics on screen because they're cheaper to buy in digital format. And also, it's just something easy. It's not taking up as much space. I'm running out of bookshelf space at home. And I read some novels on screen as well too. But I think with little kids, it's important we still have the page.
James, we're coming towards the end of our discussion. It's been really lovely talking to you. No doubt have other projects on the go. We're going to meet Stella again?
I'm not sure. I'd never considered a sequel for Stella, but so far Stella's been really successful, so you're not the first person who's asked me about that. But where would...
It's a huge universe we live in.
Yeah, exactly right. I'm not sure, you know, where she would go next. She's already been to space. Usually that's what you reserve for a book series when you're running out of ideas. You send them to space. But I've got another project I've got to start later this year, which is with Scholastic, a new graphic novel series, which is really exciting, something brand new. And that'll be out in February 2023 at this stage.
So who are we looking at, young adults?
No, it'll be for primary school kids.
Primary school kids.
Yeah, yeah. So that's going to be really fun.
And you have lurking in you some adult novel?
No, I don't think so. I mean, and that's not to say that the books I've made are not accessible to adults. Like, they can totally read them if they want to. But no, if you mean sort of like more serious literary sort of plots and topics and stuff, it's not something that's ever really interested me. I don't mind reading them, but I don't think it's something that's in me to make. I'm much more happy and focused on making stories primarily for children.
Well, it's a wonderful endeavour. It's great reading books with kids.
Yes.
And if people were looking to make a little plug, a lovely Christmas gift to their grandkids, their
indeed,
children, their
yes,
kids next door, Stellafin.
For sure.
Fremantle Press, what a beautiful...
For
beautiful
every child book in your life, if you like. Buy as many copies as you want to.
Lovely talking to you. Thanks very much, James.
Thanks so much.